This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. Dozens of kids mill around a sprawling field of grass on a warm fall day in Biloxi, Mississippi. They stare up at a man in his 60s who's dressed in 19th century clothing.
Somebody fired one off. Mm-hmm. And then we'd go through the process of going through here, packing it down. You heard it when it packed that gunpowder? Did y'all hear that?
Mm-hmm. There's a table heaped with relics from the Civil War. Satchels, binoculars, saddles, guns. And other adults dressed in Civil War costumes show the kids how to load a musket.
Stick that down in here. Then you get ready. And for display purposes only, we're going to
no bullet,
fire.
Just powder, which still makes plenty of noise.
Fire in the hole!
Fire in the hole!
There's more musket fire to come. The main event this weekend will be a mock Civil War battle, part of the annual fall muster. But the real fireworks come in the words the kids hear from the reenactors who talk about old times that are definitely not forgotten, but not accurately remembered.
You see, a Civil War is where one bunch of folks tries to overthrow the government, the sitting government, and we weren't doing that.
The kids here are on a school field trip. And they mainly look confused, like they know something isn't quite right here. You can especially see it in the faces of some of the African-American students when a Confederate flag is unfurled and held up above them.
We wanted to establish our own country. We didn't care that the North carried on and kept going the way they were going. That was fine with us. Just leave us alone. Let us build our own country.
This alternative version of history is coming from a man dressed like Jefferson Davis, who was the president of the Confederacy. This place is Davis's former home, a vast estate called Beauvoir. Today, it's a monument to everything he stood for. In debates over Confederate sites like Beauvoir and statues like Robert E. Lee in Charlottesville, you'll hear people defend them by saying they're a part of our heritage, part of our history, but how is that history being told? And more importantly, who's paying to keep it alive? That's what Brian Palmer and Seth Fried Wessler wanted to find out. They're reporters with the Investigative Fund, our partners on today's show. Over the past year, Brian and Seth have visited nearly 50 Confederate sites, including Beauvoir. They pick up the story at last year's fall muster.
Brian and I decide to take different cars to Beauvoir and spend the next 2 days reporting separately. As a white reporter, I blend in here, where, aside from some of the school kids, almost everyone is white. It had been like that at more than a dozen other Confederate sites I visited for this story. But for Brian, it was different.
As an African-American reporter, I stick out. I feel that people see black before they see anything else. Reporting on our own, we can find out whether people will open up to us differently.
Madam, next to that little tree, move back, please.
We arrive in time for fall muster. Men dressed in Union and Confederate uniforms line up on either side of a long field. They carry rifles and flags and push cannons into position. Then the fighting begins. Seth is in the middle of all of it.
I look around to see who's here. 500 people, maybe, sit in bleachers or stand nearby. Families with young children carry Confederate flags. Old bearded men wear biker vests with these Sons of Confederate Veterans patches sewn on. Two younger men wear army camouflage.
Some people want to talk to me. They tell me stories of loyal slaves and so-called black Confederates. I make sure to keep my distance from Seth so he can do his thing and I can do mine.
Run, Yankees, run! Run!
I meet an older couple from Virginia who tell me they drove down to support the flag and celebrate their heritage. They love it here.
This is the lady I mentioned.
And they want me to meet someone. Her name is Susan Hathaway.
She is the founder.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you? So I just remind me, you're the founder of...
The Virginia Flaggers.
Oh, wow.
The Virginia Flaggers is a group that protests whenever they hear of plans to remove Confederate statues and flags.
On the highways, mega battle flags all over Virginia.
Anywhere a monument is being debated. And for Hathaway, this place, Beauvoir, is hallowed ground.
It's just kind of a holy place for us with Confederate ancestry. And the things they've done here are just amazing. To be able to walk where Jefferson Davis walked.
Do you think of it that way, as a kind
Absolutely. As a place where we can come and express our appreciation and our love of our heritage without having anybody to sit here and try to tell us what they think it's about and what we need to do. And if they would just leave us alone, we would be fine. God save the South! Woo!
At this point, I'm kind of at a loss for words. It sounds like she's saying that the federal government should just leave the South alone. As I look around at the crowd, it's clear to me that she's only talking about one part of the South. The white South.
We're proud to be Southern. It's like Southern is the only thing you're not allowed to be proud of anymore. You can be proud to be African American, you can be proud to be Irish American, you can be proud, but you can't be proud to be Confederate American or to say you're even from the South.
This is a message Seth and I heard not just here, but at a number of Confederate sites we visited, including a cemetery in Virginia and a library in Alabama. One thing they had in common: the Sons of Confederate Veterans, which also owns Beauvoir. The Sons is a national organization with dozens of chapters, founded in 1896. Only male descendants of Confederate veterans can join. The group's mission is to vindicate the cause that Confederates fought for. During the mock battle, we see their version of history play out. Muskets crack, units advance, and men fall down dead in the field. The Confederates beat back the Union troops. No actual Civil War battle took place here, but at Beauvoir, the Confederacy always wins.
The next day, Brian and I return to Beauvoir. It's raining hard and the muster is canceled. So we get a chance to interview Thomas Paine, who was then Beauvoir's executive director. His assistant meets us at the door.
All right, great.
Hey, how are you?
I didn't know y'all were together.
We operate separately.
Oh, okay. We enter Payne's office.
Yeah, that rifle right there, that's the oldest thing in here.
An old rifle hangs on the wall to his right. Pictures of Confederate leaders are behind him, and a set of three flags, Mississippi, American, and Confederate, are planted on his desk.
Payne is a white man in his 60s with a salt and pepper mustache. He's a lawyer with a PhD in adult education. He's not a member of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, but he tells us he's eligible to be one. For now, he just works for them.
Is that Beauvoir is not just a place, it's a place in time. You should be feeling like you're actually walking back in time as a witness to what took place. So I want this to be an educational institution that tells the truth, and then people will come here, know that they can depend on the information that they're getting, good, the bad, and the ugly.
We already knew what kind of information Payne was talking about because the day before our interview, I shelled out my $12.50 to take a tour of the house where Davis lived in his final years.
Look at the chairs, how short and close to the ground they are.
Donna Barnes is the guide. She wears a full Gone with the Wind dress, and as you'll hear, she has a Scarlett O'Hara view of the Civil War.
You look from the wall to the ceiling. Looks like some of the most beautiful crown molding, rich with color, and beautiful to see.
We experience this at site after site, places where Confederate leaders, who were slaveholders, once lived. Minute details about the furnishings, but near silence about slavery.
It's interesting to me that that's not built into the tour. Why isn't it?
I don't know. I guess because you cannot say. I guess because I'd be here all day if I told everything about the Davises. Thank y'all so much for coming.
Donna and I step out, and I ask her how she answers questions from tourists about slavery.
I want to tell them the honest truth about it, that slavery was good and bad. It was good for the people that didn't know how to take care of themselves and they needed a job. And you had good slave owners like Jefferson Davis, who took care of his slaves and treated them like family. He loved them.
They were not family. They were property. Jefferson Davis, who led a would-be nation created to defend slavery, owned dozens of people, black people. And this place, the historic Beauvoir estate, was built with enslaved labor.
The idea that Davis's slaves were happy echoes through his memoir, which he wrote in this very house. In speaking about African Americans, he said, "Their servile instincts rendered them contented with their lot." This idea, which is perhaps too controversial to hang on the walls, still hangs in the air here.
And Brian and I encountered it at other Confederate sites we visited, where, to this day, Confederate leaders are portrayed as benign and beloved by those they held in bondage, not only distorting history, but denying the lived experience of millions of enslaved people.
My own great-grandparents were among those millions. Both of them, Matt and Julia Palmer, escaped slavery in Virginia. Matt joined the United States Colored Troops, the U.S. Army's segregated black fighting force. Julia and her family fled to Union-held territory. They emancipated themselves, like 500,000 others before the war's end. We wanted to know why, in 2018, history was still being erased and distorted here. These are the questions we had for Beauvoir's then-executive director, Thomas Paine.
An enormous part of the story is the African-American part of the story,
nope.
And that's not reflected here at all.
I don't disagree with you. The large part of that is because that's where they placed us, 1877 to 1889,
well,
and we have to stay true to that.
It's true. Beauvoir is designated as a state and national historic site because Davis lived here after the Civil War. Paine claims that the site must stick with that specific time, 1877 to 1889, when Davis died. But on our visit, stories and memorabilia about the Civil War, 12 years before that period, were everywhere.
This was not an island, right? And you do talk about the Civil War. You got a whole room dedicated to the
Confederate soldier, yeah.
Absolutely. So,
what would you change? Tell me what you would change and how I should do that.
Well, I mean, that has consistently been my question to you.
I do think we need to talk more about slavery. And the reason I got that was not from the kids. We have a lot of our young kids who come here and they want to know where the whipping post was at. And the way we handle that, since they're young kids, we don't have a whipping post.
So what I hear him saying is that we can't talk about slavery at all because kids can't handle it. But what about those Civil War battles? We watched a lot of people fall down playing dead in a field. That kind of violence that glorifies the Confederacy is A-OK here. But the violence of slavery, Beauvoir steers clear of that.
We're judging a lot of what happened in the 19th century with our 20th and 21st century glasses, so to speak. We're looking through lenses of the 20th and 21st century and saying, oh, that's terrible.
We've heard this before. You can't judge slavery by today's standards. But we don't need to. Abolitionists, including the formerly enslaved, argued against the system while it was happening for the same reason we argue against it today. It was wrong. And yet Paine defends Davis.
I think that would be an honest perception that he was a benevolent slaveholder.
There's no way to benevolently own another person's body, another person's life, another person's future. That phrase, benevolent slaveholder, is straight up lost cause language.
So here's a term we need to understand, lost cause. Confederates who lost the war devised this idea of the lost cause, It's a whole false interpretation of history designed to justify their defeat, to absolve themselves of any guilt for starting the war, and to vindicate their pre-war way of life. And this story is still being told at Beauvoir.
The larger goal of these once powerful men was to end the process that was reordering Southern society, Reconstruction. They wanted to redeem their status, their power, and their control over Black lives and labor.
These fantasies persist because people have to believe. They have to believe that they fought for something greater than the continued subjugation of another human being.
Christy Coleman is a longtime administrator of historic sites, and she's currently the CEO of the American Civil War Museum in Richmond, Virginia. She's an African-American woman, and the center she runs tells a story of the Civil War that's complicated, at times ugly, and it includes the perspectives of African-Americans free and enslaved, and of Union and Confederate soldiers. In other words, the full story.
It's almost laughable when I read some of these diary entries about these owners, these slaveholders, who are just so mortified that, well, Jenny's been with me since she was 6 years old, and the fact that she ran off with those Yankees and da-da-da-da-da-da, I'm just sure that they, you know, overwhelmed her little fragile mind. But this is the same woman that you've had whipped several times because she has run away on her own long before the war. There was just this cognitive dissonance related to it that is really stunning.
These claims often come with stories. One of them is sitting on Beauvoir's front lawn, which takes us back to that tour Seth went on with Donna Barnes. After all the visitors left, he and Donna kept talking.
Right there, that statue is of Jefferson Davis. When you're looking at it, his son Joseph is on the right. On the left is his adopted black son, Jim Limber.
Jim Limber. Donna says that during the war, the Davises had rescued a free black child from abusive relatives and took him in as their own. There's a children's book that tells the same story, and you can buy it in the Beauvoir store.
The historical record about this child is slim. It's generally understood that his name was James Henry Brooks. Nobody really knows how he entered the Davis household, or if he was legally enslaved or free. The Davis's own account is the only one we have. In the words of Jefferson Davis's wife, Verena, the family brought him into their home as a pet for their children, not a brother.
We got that statue by default. That statue was commissioned to go to Richmond, Virginia. They didn't want it when it came because of the black child in it. When they told us it was Jim Limber and Joseph, we jumped in the air and we said, please, we'll take it. Because somebody did not want it because it had the black child in it.
That's hilarious. That is hilarious. That's now how it went down, and all of it is public knowledge.
Christy Coleman says that Donna's version of the Jim Limber story is not actually what happened. Just after Christy came to the Civil War Center, she learned that the Sons of Confederate Veterans had donated the statue to the center. She consulted with Davis historians and other scholars. They told her that the statue was less a representation of any true history than a work of propaganda.
The stories that they're telling in the material that you've sent me are patently untrue. I think it's historically horrible, and I can't imagine you guys would accept it. We refer to the enslaved population as servants, as if this is some benign institution. And that's, again, was a part of the Lost Cause narrative that, you know, we were just fine down here with our Negroes. You have a narrative that makes people comfortable for the spaces that they're in.
We thought a lot about what Christy had to say, that these places are set up to feed on people's ignorance and make them feel comfortable about America's violent and racist past. Comfortable with a false history of America, one that honors the Confederacy and everything it stood for.
By now, we'd been digging for months into exactly who runs these sites. But we had another question. Who's paying to keep them open? We filed dozens of public records requests and sifted through piles of tax filings to find out where the money was coming from. And we were stunned by what we were starting to find.
Taxpayer money is keeping these places open. And Beauvoir is a huge beneficiary. We tallied all of the public monies Beauvoir says it received from 2007 through 2016. It added up to more than $21
million. $21 million. All from taxpayers. So how does that end up happening? And how many other Confederate sites are we, the taxpayers, paying for? When we come back, Investigative Fund reporters Seth Fried Wessler and Brian Palmer follow the money that supports this lost cause mythology in the 21st century. That's next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose, so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. A network of anti-democratic groups are attacking these freedoms, seeking to force us all to live by their narrow beliefs. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/MJ.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. Before the break, we visited Beauvoir, former home to Confederate President Jefferson Davis in Biloxi, Mississippi. We heard how the staff there distort the history of slavery and the Civil War. Investigative Fund reporters Seth Fried Wessler and Brian Palmer also told us that Beauvoir has received $21 million in taxpayer money, money that is helping to tell these historic lies to the public, including school children. So, Brian, can you explain where all that money came from?
Beauvoir gets $100,000 every year from the Mississippi State Legislature. The state says the money should be spent only on the building, which is a National Historic Landmark. But after Hurricane Katrina, Beauvoir got a huge infusion of public money. The storm damaged the buildings there. Remember, it's right on the Gulf of Mexico. And FEMA and the National Park Service sent more than $17 million to help out. But that money didn't just go to restoring historic buildings. Almost half went to creating a new museum and library from scratch. And that's where you hear this lost cause version of history, of benevolent slave owners and heroic Confederates.
So millions of public dollars are supporting this lost cause mythology as told at Beauvoir. But you guys also found that a lot of taxpayer money is going to other places around the South, both private and public. Seth, how much money are we talking about?
Al, we found that over the last decade, at least $40 million have flowed to Confederate sites and organizations. We visited dozens of these places, and we would often hear some version of this myth that slavery wasn't so bad. In Georgia, for example, I heard this on the tour of A.H. Stevens State Park. Stevens was the vice president of the Confederacy.
Mr. Stevens was real good to his servants. He treated them like family.
Georgia has spent over $1 million on this park in the last decade. And then there's this in Mississippi. I recorded it on a tour of a historic site dedicated to Stephen D. Lee, a Confederate lieutenant. They got $30,000 from the state.
When it was started, a lot of widows were being taken advantage of and thrown off and different things. So their idea was they were going to be like a militia to protect people.
She's talking about the Ku Klux Klan. She told me that the KKK had been misunderstood, that the group was formed to protect widows after the war. She left out that 19 people were lynched in the very same county where we were standing.
Okay. So now, in each of these cases, we hear this warped history of places supported by public money. Brian, where else are you seeing this happen?
Al, we found that a big chunk of public money goes directly to Confederate heritage organizations, the United Daughters of the Confederacy and Sons of Confederate Veterans. Some of that money goes to maintain specific sites, like a Confederate cemetery I visited here in Virginia back in April.
I'm entering the Confederate section of Oakwood Cemetery here in Richmond, Virginia. And there's a gentleman who looks to be directing traffic. Can you tell me what you're doing here today and why we're here today?
Yeah, today is Confederate Memorial Day.
Not to be confused with actual Memorial Day, Confederate Memorial Day is celebrated in late April. It's an official holiday in three states, an unofficial holiday in other southern states, including Virginia.
And it's 17,000 Confederate soldiers buried here, and we want to honor our ancestors.
I salute the Confederate flag with affection, reverence, and undying devotion to the cause for which it stands.
That's Susan Hathaway, the founder of the Virginia Flaggers. She's the woman Seth met earlier, who called Beauvoir a holy place. She stands in front of a small crowd on a patch of the well-tended lawn, her back to a memorial obelisk erected in 1871.
And if you would all join me in singing our state song, because it is still our state song, Carry Me Back to Old Virginia. Carry me back to old Virginia. There's where the cotton and the corn and taters grow. There's where the birds warble sweet in the springtime. There's where this old darky's heart ere long to go. There's where I labored so hard for old massa.
I'm standing here listening to this song, which hasn't been the state song since 1997, by the way, with lyrics like Darky and Massa. I'm the great-grandson of enslaved people in a cemetery that borders an African-American neighborhood. All of this is strange. I understand that cemeteries were and are memorial sites, places of mourning. But right after the Civil War, these burial grounds, as well as monuments, became central to the politics of those white Southerners trying to rebuild their pre-war power. Another way they reclaimed that power, they stripped black people of their newly won right to vote.
Black people had largely been driven violently from the polls. Very, very few black people could vote.
That's Ibram X. Kendi. He's director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center at American University.
Very simply, black people did not have the ability to vote out of office people who were advancing public policies to build Confederate monuments.
Money from the Commonwealth of Virginia has continued to flow to these burial grounds and monuments, and they've become pilgrimage sites for Confederate sympathizers and white supremacists. Professor Kendi says, when public dollars go to Confederate monuments, we all support what they stand for.
Investing a single dollar in Confederate monuments is essentially investing dollars in racism, in slavery, and in white supremacy.
So how much money has the public invested in Confederate cemeteries in Virginia? We went digging in the state's official archive, the Library of Virginia. We read through more than 100 years of legislative reports, all the way back to 1902. We found that Virginia taxpayers have spent about $9 million in today's dollars to fund organizations set up to take care of Confederate graves. Some of that money is channeled to the Sons of Confederate Veterans. Seth met up with members of the group at the same cemetery I visited.
How are you, sir? This is your ancestor's grave.
Well, so. we look after, of course, all of them that we can, but that happens to be a cousin, yes.
I'm here with five men. They use a dolly to unload two newly cut gravestones from the bed of a truck. They claim the men buried here as their ancestors. Edwin Ray is a longtime member of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, and until he retired, he was a research librarian at the Library of Virginia.
People talk about the lost cause, you know, like we're adhering to some sort of myth or something. Well, that's not the case. We are remembering the way things were supposed to be And if we lose this style of government that was handed down to us, then it is a lost cause.
These men draw on carefully constructed myths about the Confederacy and about slavery, and fundamentally about white innocence.
Granted, I'm sure there's a few plantation owners that treated their people bad, but the greater majority of them didn't. Would you go buy a brand new car and take it home and beat it up with a hammer? You know? I mean, to buy a slave back then was like buying a car today, you know? Cost a lot of money.
That's Kent Morris. He's wearing a white bandana and a white T-shirt with a Southern Heritage Defense Team logo on it. Brian and I have met a lot of sons of Confederate veterans over the last year. In Virginia, in Alabama, in Kentucky, in Mississippi. They make a point to distance themselves from white supremacists. But white supremacists, including the KKK, and more recently Unite the Right, have used Confederate sites as rallying points.
If you let an inanimate object, like a piece of granite or marble or whatever, if that hurts your feelings, you got troubles. You know?
Morris tells me that if African Americans don't like Confederate monuments, they should just build their own.
Do the same thing that our ancestors did. Get up enough money, find a place to build it, and build your own. You
know? But one way his ancestors got up enough money was by using their political power to channel taxpayer dollars to Confederate cemeteries and other sites across the South. African American leaders have tried to stop that flow of public money from the start, most recently in Richmond, where Brian lives.
In fact, if these statues are heritage, then your heritage is hate. And I'm sorry
that... At a sparsely attended meeting of the Richmond City Council earlier this year, Councilman Michael J. Jones introduced a resolution to bring five Confederate monuments under city control.
It's a systemic reality of racism. Any law that would disenfranchise an individual needs to be done away with. Period.
It's a symbolic effort, because Virginia is one of seven states that has passed laws putting the fate of monuments in the hands of the state.
We should have the right to have the discussion, but then the authority to do what we want to do, and not someone that I know hated black folk who wrote legislation.
Councilman Jones joins a long tradition of African American resistance in Richmond and across the South. Way back in 1890, another member of the Richmond City Council, John Mitchell Jr., tried to block city funding of the Robert E. Lee Monument in his city. Mitchell lost that fight. 125 years later, that monument to Confederate Robert E. Lee is one of the five that Jones wants to bring under city control. He has a suggestion for people who claim these monuments as part of their heritage.
If they want to own that heritage, they're fine to do it. Doesn't make it right. Doesn't mean that it's worthy to be lifted up for everyone. Then take them to your house. Put them in your backyard. Do what you want with it.
Back at the Confederate cemetery, Edwin Ray tells me that losing their memorial sites could lead to violence.
Our preference is to fight these battles in court as we have and at the ballot box. We don't want to go to war with anybody, but our ancestors had to do that. And if we're half the men they were, it may come to a time when we have to do that as well.
For now, those Confederate statues aren't going anywhere.
Mr. Jones.
Aye.
Ms. Robertson.
Aye.
Ms. Larson.
No.
That paper has not been adopted.
Michael Jones lost his bid to bring the Confederate statues under the control of Richmond in a 6-3 vote. But throughout the fight, Jones was confident that eventually everything will come to a head in Richmond.
Richmond will be ground zero for this at some point in time. It's going to come. As every statue is removed from Texas all the way to Tupelo, Mississippi, all the way up the Atlantic coast, as they're all addressed, it's going to end right here. It's going to end right here in Richmond.
Why?
Because it was the epicenter. This was the capital of the Confederacy. So it's got to end here. There's an African proverb that says, you know, until the lion learns to write, the hunter will always be the hero, okay? And so black folk know how to write now. And not only do we know how to write legislation. So the line's going right.
As we've been reporting this story, visiting these sites, Brian and I have been thinking about these claims that Confederate sites are just history, and everyone's history deserves to be preserved. Those arguments fall apart when you go to a place where Brian has spent hundreds of hours over the past 4 years.
They need my digger. I'm in the middle of a huge forest not far from the center of Richmond, Virginia, with my wife Erin and other members of the Friends of East End. It's a group we volunteer with. We're reclaiming history from nature. We make our way through weeds, dead leaves, and fallen limbs. Erin spots a tiny patch of white stone beneath thick ivy. I attack it with pruning shears. She slowly removes layers of dirt from the stone. A name appears. Dora Pegram, died October 20th, 1919. This is East End, a historic black cemetery. Once a beautifully manicured source of pride for Richmond's black community, it's been destroyed by nature, vandalism, trash dumping, and neglect. If you look down on this spot from the sky, all you'd see are treetops. But if your eye wanders north just a bit, the forest practically touches another graveyard. It's all neat with tidy rows of headstones and markers. The special section in Oakwood Cemetery, where Confederate soldiers are buried. At this cemetery, plots have been maintained for all these years with the help of public dollars, by groups that continue to sell an antiquated and wrong version of American history. Jim Crow sent his money where you'd expect, to these white cemeteries, Confederate cemeteries, and to Confederate shrines and statues across the South. More than 150 years after the Civil War, and 50 years after the end of Jim Crow rule in the South, that money still flows.
I want to thank reporters Brian Palmer and Seth Fried Wessler of the Investigative Fund, our partner on today's show, and Reveal's Fernanda Camarena, who produced the story. Brian and Seth wrote a stunning piece for Smithsonian Magazine about Confederate monuments called The Cost of the Confederacy. You can find a link to it at our website, revealnews.org. When we come back, another debate over monuments that pits neighbor against neighbor. This is Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. And this last story is about a fight over a monument to American history centuries before the Civil War. Way back in 1598, when the place we now call New Mexico was colonized for the first time by the Spanish. And this fight wasn't about tearing a monument down. It was about how to make one in the first place. Reveal's Stan Alcorn grew up in New Mexico and has been following this story since middle school. He takes it from here.
When Nora Naranjo Morse got the call to help make what would become the most controversial monument in New Mexico history, she was in the place she's most comfortable. The studio where she makes her art.
I mean, who would want to be here, right? In the studio with a fireplace in the rain.
It was 1997. And the director of public art for the city of Albuquerque was on the phone asking if she wanted to be part of a tricultural collaboration. There'd be a Hispanic artist, an Anglo artist, and he hoped, Nora, a Tewa Indian artist from Santa Clara Pueblo.
The call was so out of the blue. This was a public art project. I'd never done public art, really. This was with other people. I had been working solo.
And did you say yes right then, or do you remember how the phone
call? I said yes. I said yes right away because I opened my mouth and I said yes. And then afterwards I thought, oh, I wonder what this is going to be like.
The assignment was to create a memorial for the Cuarto Centenario, a celebration of the 400th anniversary of the state's first Spanish colony and of its founder, Juan de Oñate.
Viva Oñate, viva, viva, viva la historia de este
Nora knew of an Oñate printing company. She'd driven down Oñate Street. There's an equestrian statue of Oñate in full armor on the side of a highway near her house. But what she remembers actually learning about Oñate, the historical figure, from her middle school social studies teacher, was just that he was a kind of Spanish founding father.
And by the time I was in junior high and I was seeing this stuff, I thought it was okay to ask questions.
What was the question you asked?
Well, where are the Indians in this? And he got sort of beet red, and he told me to be quiet and sit down. I never forgot it. It was one of those seminal moments where I realized, oh, I can't ask these questions because they'll make somebody in a place of authority uncomfortable.
You can't answer Nora's question without talking about Acoma. It's one of dozens of pueblos, as the Spanish called Native American settlements, that Oñate encountered in New Mexico. The year after he founded the first colony, some of his men went to Acoma demanding food, and 13 of them were killed. In response, Oñate declared a war of blood and fire. His soldiers killed hundreds of Acoma men, women, and children, and Oñate himself sentenced the adults to 20 years of slavery, and the adult men to have one foot chopped off. This was the history that Nora and I and anyone in New Mexico who followed the news was about to learn in detail. Because within a couple weeks of Nora's phone call, an envelope showed up on the desk of Larry Calloway, a columnist at the Albuquerque Journal.
It was sort of a combination of a press release and a ransom note and a photo.
The photo was a Polaroid of a bronze boot and spur that had been chopped off the Oñate statue near Nora's house.
And I read the note, and it said, "We took the liberty of removing Oñate's right foot on behalf of our brothers and sisters at Acoma Pueblo. We will be melting this foot down and casting small medallions to be sold to those who are historically ignorant."
The note went on to say they'd done it for the 400th anniversary of the, quote, unasked-for exploration of our land. In other words, the point was to spoil the party that Nora had just become a part of. And when Larry's story came out, and it was picked up by NPR and the New York Times, that is exactly what happened.
I still didn't see the storm that was coming. It was still in its infancy.
Conchita Lucero was one of the founding members of a group that would fight for the Oñate statue as the New Mexico Hispanic Culture Preservation League. And for them, Oñate filled a different kind of gap in the history books.
When I was a child, at 10 years of age, I asked my grandmother, who was a school teacher, I was reading the American history books, I said, "Didn't our people do anything?" You know, that's how I felt.
All Conchita knew was that her family had been in New Mexico for centuries, way longer than the Anglo classmates who called people like her dirty Mexicans. But it wasn't until many decades later, after she retired and joined a local genealogical society, that she started learning history by studying her family tree. She found some Native American ancestors, but she was most excited about the ones who came from Europe, way back in the 16th century, like one of Oñate's captains.
You'd start finding your family members and you were going, wow, I never knew they did all of this.
Did it change how you saw yourself?
Yes. I never argued that one person wasn't as good as the other, but sometimes you were made to feel inferior. And at that point, that inferiority left.
And so when the Cuarto Centenario rolled around, she was in the group that met with the Albuquerque Arts Board to discuss a possible bronze statue of Oñate, the man they called the father of the Hispanic culture and our state.
Was what happened at Acoma brought up?
No. No.
And was it on your mind?
No.
Was it something that you knew about?
I wasn't as versed in it as I have become.
Acoma today is a place where tens of thousands of tourists go to buy pottery and visit houses built centuries ago out of mud and sandstone on top of a 400-foot mesa.
If you happen to fall over the edge, this is the end of your tour, and no refunds will be given, so just keep that in mind, okay?
But it's not just a tourist attraction. Most of New Mexico's pueblos disappeared after the Spanish came, but Acoma survived, and some of the 6,000 enrolled members would lead the resistance to the Albuquerque Oñate Memorial, like Alida Suazo, who goes by Tweety.
What did you know about the history of your people in that place?
That we came from the underworld on the back of Grandmother Spider. We wandered the earth, and when we got to where Acoma was, we were told this is where we're supposed to be. That's what I knew, you know, that we've been there forever.
She knew that when the Spanish came, they'd done terrible things to her ancestors. But it was only when the statue foot-cutting hit the news that she learned it was this Juan de Oñate who gave the orders, and that Oñate was later banished from New Mexico by the Spanish crown for reasons including his cruelty to the innocent at Acoma.
That was everybody's first awareness.
And at the same time, she learned the city of Albuquerque was considering building a new monument to him.
He had been cast out of New Mexico forever. And now you want to bring him back and put him on a statue? It's still mind-boggling.
The city could see that another Oñate on a horse would be a bad look. Their solution was to add Nora to the project, to make it a tricultural collaboration, and to tell the three artists they had to include not only Oñate, but the settlers he brought and the native peoples who'd been there for centuries. But when Nora showed up to the first meeting, the other two artists wheeled in a model they'd already put together, and it was Oñate on a horse. One of them suggested Nora could work on the pedestal beneath the horse's hooves.
I felt insulted. I felt hurt. I felt marginalized. I didn't think I could do that. Although in myself, I was thinking that there was a solution, that art could tell a story that was truthful.
It brought her back to that middle school social studies class, asking the uncomfortable question. But she was able to get them to scrap this idea and start over. And then she started getting calls from other Pueblo people. They were asking her to quit in protest.
I didn't do that. And when I refused, I think people were disappointed. But I realized that by me staying in the game, I would at least be able to fight for that voice that I think was so important. Not just my artistic voice, but the voice of these people that had gone through this incredible experience that changed their culture completely. And I kept going back to those things.
The memorial had become this very public test of whether New Mexico was the land of tricultural harmony that it claimed to be. But as the year of the Cuarto Centenario, 1998, came and went, Nora and the other artists stopped speaking to each other. And the project went from one artwork to two, a series of bronze sculptures of Spanish settlers, including Oñate, and a land art installation that was Nora's response. The whole thing would take up most of a city block and cost over $500,000. Now the question was, did the city want it?
This is GOV-14. And now from Government Center in downtown Albuquerque, the Albuquerque City Council.
The council chambers were packed. The public seating was divided like a pep rally or Congress.
We will move to public comments now.
On the pro-Oñate side was a group of older Hispanic men and women.
John Lucero.
Like Conchita and her husband, John.
Those of you that have Spanish ancestry should be angry.
This is a personal attack on you, your family, and your heritage.
The anti-Oñate side?
Gracias.
Next.
Was a lot younger.
Good evening, student council, our city council members.
And more diverse.
Allow me to introduce myself. I am a Chicana.
And I want to express a Jewish perspective.
I am a mestiza of mixed people. We are proud people, and that pride does not come from denying what has happened and how we came here.
Oñate does not represent the best of my culture. You are not representing me, and I just want to say that I'm sorry that you and a small group of Hispanics in this room feel like they have to slam another people's culture in order to feel pride.
Dozens of people spoke, but at the forefront, leading the movement, were women from Acoma.
Hello, everybody. How are you?
Like Tweety Suazo.
I didn't know that the awful things that happened to my people happened to my people until this statue became an issue. I'm really tired of being used as tourists, and our wares are the only things that matter in this community. I'm begging you. Don't do this to my people. Don't hurt them this way. It's not right.
Thank you very much.
Last speaker, I.L. Sanchez Davis.
This fight had been going on for 3 years, and people on all sides were demanding a decision. The memorial was a compromise, the city councilors kept saying. Oñate would not be named. He would not be on a horse. And the alternative, not building anything, if they did that, they'd be saying this whole multicultural, historical, commemorative experiment had been a failure. So they voted.
All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
They voted 7-2 to build the memorial.
That motion passes.
We worked so hard.
Tweety Suazo.
And it didn't matter. It didn't matter what we said. It didn't matter what we do. It didn't matter that we educated. It just didn't matter.
The memorial was quietly unveiled 5 years later. If you go there today, you'll see more than 24 life-sized bronze figures, men and women, oxen and sheep, trudging up a sandy hill. And at the front, you'll see Oñate in a cape and helmet, looking in the general direction of a security camera that may or may not be pointed at his feet. And then next to all that is what looks from above like a huge dirt spiral. You kind of have to experience it, which is why I met Nora Naranjo Morse there to walk into the artwork she's titled Numbi Huage, Our Center Place.
When you come down on this path, it's symbolic that you're coming into your own center place. You're coming.
As the dirt path spirals counterclockwise, you walk down into the ground. The street disappears behind the hills of desert shrubs on either side, then the buildings, then Oñate himself, until finally, at the center of the center place, if you sit down, all you see is desert and water trickling across a rock.
And I like that very much because I think that's what it was like a long time ago. That's how I interpret the past.
It's a glimpse of a world before Oñate arrived. But it's also intended as a confrontation between two totally different worldviews. Because as you walk back out of the spiral...
This is what you see. The telephone lines, the sculpture of Oñate coming here, looking north, the stoplight, it's all there. And so you see that in some ways when they came, they brought us great opportunity, but at such a high cost. The brutal colonization was forever affecting to us. And I think we should never forget that.
And she hopes that some of the people who come to see Oñate and the Spanish settlers will step into her artwork, too, and see what she sees.
That story from Reveal's Dan Alcorn. Our lead producer this week was Fernanda Camarena. Our executive producer, Kevin Sullivan, edited the show, along with Jen Gian. Thanks to editor Esther Kaplan of the Investigative Fund, our partner on today's show. We had research help from Jasper Craven, Aaron Holloway Palmer, and Richard Zalema. Special thanks to Roman Garcia, KUNM, and the podcast 99% Invisible, which you can check out this week for more on the story of Oñate's foot. Our production manager is Mwende Inahosa. Our sound design team is the dynamic duo Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man Yo Aruda, who also composed the original score for this hour. Additional engineering from Joe Plord, Garrett Tiedemann, and Caitlin Benz. Our senior supervising editor is Taki Telenitas. Our CEO is Krista Scharfenberg. Our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Edson. And remember, there is always more to the story.